on their own 2 feet.
The rule does not impact humanitarian-based immigration programs for refugees and contains some exemptions for victims of trafficking and domestic violence. One woman was injured during a stabbing attack in downtown Sydney Tuesday. Police in Australia's largest city say the man unsuccessfully tried to stab other pedestrians as he ran through the central business district during the lunchtime hours. The man was later caught by several pedestrians, with the video showing the man pinned to the ground by a crate and a chair as his pursuers cursed him. For more on these stories, voanews.com. I'm Joe Palca, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Rwanda remains prepared to provide our own modest involvement, support, sanctuary for those migrants who wish to come here or through here.
That's Rwandan President Paul Kagame on a plan for his country to accept 500 migrants trapped in Libya. Details coming up also. The World Health Organization is welcoming new treatments for Ebola as a positive step in tackling the epidemic. The UN Children's Agency says the spread of violence in Mali is hitting children particularly hard. And Cameroon has threatened all journalists who, it says, are refusing to be patriotic. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the governments of France, Italy, the United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, and the United States have welcomed the announcement of a truce in Libya on the occasion of Eid al-Adha. This in response to the special representative of the UN Secretary General with the support of the Security Council. They have invited all parties to cease hostilities across Libya. Reaffirmed today by the Security Council, this truce should be accompanied by confidence-building measures that can pave the way for a sustainable ceasefire and a return to constructive, inclusive dialogue on the country's future. In a joint statement, the six countries urged all parties to resume efforts under the auspices of the special representative to build a lasting political solution based on principles agreed upon in three previous rounds of talks. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Wolfgang Pushtai, policy and security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, about prospects and challenges of reaching a ceasefire agreement.
There was a UN proposal for a ceasefire on the recent Festival of the Sacrifice, the most important Islamic holiday, and it was violated numerous times from both sides. Pro-GNA militias even started a large attack on Tripoli Airport on Monday during the last hours of the ceasefire. So I would say, although both sides said that they will stick with the ceasefire, no one of them really cared. Obviously, there is not a lot of interest in the ceasefire. The question is for me also, who could be the partners of such an agreement? On one side, yes, it's the LNA. But on the other side, the GNA cannot talk for the militias fighting in Tripoli. So should the partner for the LNA for the discussion and for the agreement be the city of Misrata? Or maybe the loose Burkhan al-Gadab Operation Vulcano Militia Coalition? That's a good question.
But the UN Security Council stressed that this truce should be accompanied by confidence-building measures between the parties that can pave the way for a sustainable ceasefire and a return to inclusive dialogue. What are the challenges facing such move?
First step of such confidence-building measures could be that troops, ammunition and military hardware is not posted in and near hospitals, mosques or universities anymore, and that sites protected by the Red Crescent symbol are not attacked anymore, but both sides are still doing this. There is no confidence that could be built on whatsoever. There is nobody who could supervise these measures on the ground. Furthermore, both sides are really pouring oil on the fire of the conflict. To be honest, I don't see any realistic chance for confidence-building measures or real reconciliation in Libya anytime soon. the future for the country is not to build on reconciliation, but to build on a decentralized stabilization approach.
The six governments reminded regional and international players of the obligation under the international law for all UN member states to abide by the arms embargo to Libya. Would that prevent the current intervention by countries like Egypt, Turkey, and France?
France is not delivering arms to the Libyans, but the other two, Egypt, Turkey, and several other countries, certainly do. Such an obligation will certainly not stop the arms deliveries. And UN also has no means to control if the arms embargo is kept by the sides, yes or no. So, no.
The joint statement called on parties to start working with no delay on a ceasefire agreement and resume efforts under the auspices of the Special Representative of the United Nations to build a lasting political solution. Is there any chance to achieve this goal under the current circumstances?
No, I don't see any chance for this. This is entirely unrealistic and it also doesn't make sense. The principles agreed upon in Paris, Palermo, and Abu Dhabi are to hold elections in the near future. But the country is still in any aspect far away from holding elections under democratic rules. So any kind of elections would not be up to even moderate Western standards. Free and fair elections are an illusion in the current situation. It would be really necessary for the international community to realize that the current political framework, the UN-brokered Libya political agreement, which established also the government of national accord, is dead. It's really a dead horse which is ridden here. It would make much more sense to prepare for a political solution after the fighting in Tripoli has ended in one way or the other. It is necessary to look for a new framework. And this framework could be, from my point of view, Libya's old constitution, the Federalist Constitution from 51.
That was Wolfgang Pushtai, policy and security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Rwanda and Libya are working on an evacuation plan for 500 migrants held in detention centers in the North African country. Many Rwandans have saluted the move, saying that based on their horrific history of genocide, it's the best gift they could offer. Eugene Uwimana has more details from Kigali.
Rwanda's intervention comes amid harrowing revelations that the migrants, most from West Africa, are being sold openly in modern-day slave markets in Libya. Others have been trapped by the ongoing battle for control of the Libyan capital, Tripoli. The migrants are expected to travel under an emergency plan being discussed with international humanitarian agencies and other partners. Rwanda President Paul Kagame has offered assurances that everything is in place to host the increasingly desperate fellow Africans.
Rwanda remains prepared to provide our own modest involvement, support, sanctuary for those migrants who wish to come here or through here back to where they had come from in the first place.
For Rwandans, this sounds good based on the times they wanted help that they didn't find. Diana Eliza lives in Kigali City.
Do you reflect on Rwanda's past and what Rwanda has gone through as a country immediately after the genocide, even during the genocide that was perpetrated against the Tutsi people? Rwandans needed a rescue from other countries. They needed to move to other countries as refugees. You know, so it's something that we as Rwandans know that we would want something, another country to do for us. You know, so that's why we want to give the same help.
But others wonder if the 500 migrants can that they sought overseas, considering the level of poverty in the country.
I just doubt they are going to get what they wanted, but because some of these people, they left their countries because of different issues, some political, others economic. So if they wanted, for those people who wanted to get rich quickly from the Western countries, are they going to get that thing that they wanted from this, the European countries? Here in Rwanda, it's difficult. So,
Kagame says the starting point is a good heart that African countries must have if the continent hopes to address its widespread problems without showing empty hands to donors.
In actual fact, the first place is in our hearts. Then the second place is the physical one, which can be managed also in many different ways. So there is no country that is too small to have all its own people and others.
Rwanda's government has been hosting refugees for over two decades and coordinates the refugee response with the UN refugee agents, as well as providing land for refugee camps and ensuring camp management and security, although the dream of Europe may persist. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The World Health Organization is welcoming new treatments for Ebola as a positive step in tackling the epidemic in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, but says other factors, including community engagement, remain crucial in stopping the spread of this deadly disease. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Rigorous clinical trials of four treatments for Ebola show that two of them vastly improve the chances of survival. The World Health Organization says the use of Regen-EB3 and MAB-114 provide an effective treatment for people infected with the deadly virus. WHO calls this positive news as it provides healthcare workers with a new tool in the fight against Ebola. But WHO spokesman Christian Lindmeier cautions these new remedies alone will not stop Ebola.
What will stop Ebola under the leadership of the government in the DRC is good surveillance, good infection prevention and control, good community engagement, and excellent vaccination. So, of course, the human factor is a very important factor here. And the use of these therapeutics and the vaccinations in the most effective way possible.
The latest figures reported by WHO put the number of Ebola cases at 2,831, including nearly 1,900 deaths. The WHO is hopeful the new treatments will greatly reduce the number of people currently dying from the virus. Lindmeier says people who seek treatment soon after they become sick have the greatest chance of survival. He says it is important to come in the first 3 days.
That is saving lives, and that's clearly proven to save lives. Therefore, all efforts go into making people aware to come as early as possible, because it literally shows you with mortality rates between 6 and 11% that there's 90% chance of survival, whereas if you come late or don't look for treatment at all, there's a 90% chance of death.
Ebola lives in the forest, so it is unlikely the disease can be eradicated. WHO, however, says the new tools make it more possible to keep the virus in check. WHO says everyone must be made aware of the risks so they know what to do to save their lives. It says the best possible results will be achieved if people at high risk of Ebola are vaccinated and those who are infected are treated at an early stage. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Children's Agency says the spread of violence in Mali is hitting children particularly hard, with an estimated 377,000 in need of protection assistance. UNICEF said in a statement today that more than 150 children were killed in the first half of 2019 and 75 were injured in violent attacks. Recruitment and use of children in armed groups doubled in comparison to the same period in 2018, and more than 900 schools remain closed due to insecurity. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said, "Children should be going to school and playing with their friends, not worrying about attacks or being forced to fight." The crisis in Mali remains one of the least funded in the world. From 2016 to 2018, UNICEF's Child Protection in Emergencies program in Mali was only 26% funded. In 2019, UNICEF is seeking $4 million to meet the child protection needs of children and women in Mali. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Nineteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Governments have welcomed the announcement of a truce in Libya on the occasion of the Eid al-Adh. The World Health Organization is welcoming new treatment for Ebola as a positive step in tackling the epidemic. And the UN's Children's Agency says the spread of violence in Mali is hitting children particularly hard. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Cameroon has threatened all journalists who it says are refusing to be patriotic after TV reporter Samuel Wazizi was arrested for allegedly supporting separatist fighters in the rest of English-speaking regions. Journalists say it is becoming impossible for them to work as they face pressure from separatist fighters and the government. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Paul Atanganji, Territorial Administration Minister, says Cameroon's journalists are becoming highly unpatriotic.
They have one main objective, just to sabotage government action, to promote secessionist tendencies. I urge them to be responsible. Those who don't want to respect the laws will be booked as being recalcitrant and will be treated as such.
Atanganji also says most journalists support the opposition and believe that President Paul Biya was not the true winner of the October 2018 presidential election. Macmillan Ambe, president of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists, CAMASEJ, says the threat from the government is one of many that journalists have faced since the separatist crisis began in 2016. He says journalists should be given the freedom they need to do their work.
When you get Minister of Territorial Administration giving lessons to journalists on how to report, it just adds to some of the difficulties we are already facing. We are subjected to torture, be it physical or psychological. We've also had cases of several journalists who are being called out for questioning. So it becomes very difficult for us to operate.
Ambe was abducted by separatist fighters in the city of Bamenda last February after he criticized their call for families not to send their children to school. More recent threats came after Samuel Wazizi, an announcer at Chilean Music Television who has hosted shows critical of the government, was arrested by the military. His lawyers said he was accused of hosting separatist fighters in his farm, an allegation he dismissed. Journalist Promise Akante of Royal FM, a radio station in Yaoundé, who also hosts critical programs, says she has been threatened several times within the past 2 weeks.
I have had several phone calls threatening me. Do you know that your daughter still needs you? I said, yes, sir. So be careful with what you say on air. I don't know who was calling. The person threatened me and said, be careful with what you say on air. I'm telling you this, another person will not be this nice to you.
The separatists launched their fight in 2017 after English speakers protested political and economic discrimination in the majority French-speaking country. The government reacted with a crackdown in November 2017, and since then, 2,000 people have been killed, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Faced with a harsh trading environment back home, some Zimbabwean companies are targeting the market in neighboring Botswana. Persistent power cuts have crippled production, and some 15 companies which were in Habrone this week for a trade fair see better prospects outside Zimbabwe. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube reports.
This past week, Zimbabwe's export and investment arm, ZimTrade, welcomed the participation of 15 companies in Botswana's premier business-to-business event, Global Expo. The company's representatives acknowledged the challenges back home, which has prompted the need to look for new markets. A leading food chemicals manufacturer, CodeChem, is moving its production plant to Botswana to cushion against the effects of Zimbabwe's harsh economy. CodeChem representative Nigel Makumbe says excessive power cuts and fuel shortages have hit their business hard.
Those things are affecting us quite hard, especially the power outages, because we are having to operate only on night shifts. But with our move to move into Francistown, I think we are going to be able to set up a plant there so that we do our production from Botswana.
Ayn Bonnet runs a clothing company, Femina Garments, in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo. She says with a decline in demand for their products due to the economic situation in Zimbabwe, they've decided to look for new markets in Botswana.
Manufacture women's and children's clothing, and we're looking for either wholesalers or retailers who would like to buy our products to sell on.
Zim Trade official Similo Nkala acknowledges Zimbabwe's failing manufacturing sector and says it is key for companies to look for new export markets.
As Zim Trade, we carried out a market survey in 2018, and we discovered a lot of export opportunities that are available in Botswana for Zimbabwean companies. So we are here to explore those opportunities.
He says Zimbabwe's exports to Botswana stood at US$30 million in 2008 against Botswana's import bill of around $6 billion, a figure which he argues could be improved. Zimbabwe's Minister of Finance, Mthuli Ncube, presenting his mid-term budget review last week, predicted the economy will shrink this year due to foreign currency shortages and severe power cuts. Some companies are shutting down due to low production and a lack of foreign currency. Investing abroad may be the only way to reverse their declining fortunes. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll have an in-depth discussion on child marriage and how girls are valued around the world. Married teenage girls are often physically abused and forced into lives of chores and childbearing. The worth of a girl on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
A
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour